versus ZR Energy. Ms. Madden? Excuse me, I misspoke. I'm sorry. Mr. Griffin.
May it please the court, counsel. Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Thomas Griffin, together with Sarah Spittler. I represent ZR Energy and Joseph Praval and Arnold Berkovitz, the defendants in the underlying action, the appellants in this proceeding.
Could you keep your voice up just a little bit?
I apologize.
Thank you. That really doesn't amplify, just for courts.
We're here today asking that this court reverse the judgment of the trial court that was entered pursuant to the jury finding and the related injunction order that was entered by the court on the trade secret aspect of that jury finding. Our request that the trial court be reversed is premised upon claimed errors by the trial court below, specifically that the court erred when it denied the defendant's motion to dismiss the contract claim in the amended complaint, that the court erred in the jury instructions that it allowed to be presented to the jury with respect to the assignment of contract issues in the litigation, and that the court erred in denying defendants the opportunity to introduce Defendant's Exhibit 150, which we referred to as the Hughes memo or the Hughes aircraft memo in the proceedings below. The plaintiff's claims, Chemetall's claims in the underlying proceeding, were based on the following building blocks. A company that
Before you get to that, I mean, you have a pretty serious waiver problem, do you not, because of your failure to make a Rule 50A motion at the close of all the evidence? A number of the things that you're trying to raise will fall out of the case if that particular rule is enforced here.
With respect to waiver, Your Honors, I think we addressed that in the reply brief. The issue with respect to waiver, as it's been decided in this court, is a waiver of the claim that the evidence submitted to the jury was insufficient. That is not the premise, although that was the premise of some of the post-trial motions presented to the trial court. It's not the premise of the claims appealed in this proceeding.
But it strikes me that both the denial of the motion to dismiss the contract claim and the propriety of the jury instructions could have been raised at that point. A lot of things, in a sense, get folded into this issue. I think you have to take this as a case that was sufficient to go to the jury. And that leaves you, I think, only with your argument about Exhibit 150, which is a tough argument given the discretion the district courts have to govern decisions about admission or exclusion of evidence.
Well, Judge Wood, the Savino case, Savino v. C.P. Hall Co., 199 F. 3rd, 925, in this circuit, has expressly held that a failure to make that type of post-trial motion does not waive a appealable issue with respect to the jury instructions. And the jury instructions in this case are interwound with the contract claim in and of itself. The whole, it's all fundamentally interwound with the question of whether or not this contract was assigned in any way, shape, or form to Chemetall, who proceeded as the party to the contract, able to enforce it down below.
But, you know, on the jury instructions, and I actually, maybe it was just me, I couldn't find a copy of the actual disputed jury instruction in the record, but maybe it's in there someplace. But as far as I can tell from the things that have been placed before us, the transcript of the hearing on the jury instructions doesn't show an objection on the grounds that you're now arguing, this business about resort to parole evidence. And I'm not sure that, and that strikes me as kind of a bizarre objection, but anyway, maybe you could at least explain for us what exactly you think the problem with the jury instructions was, and tell us how you preserved that objection at the time, the precise objection, not something general.
The parole evidence issue was mischaracterized, I believe, by the defendants in their response brief. We were not saying that the use of the contract, the purchase contract, somehow constituted parole evidence. What we were suggesting was that the instructions the trial court allowed to be presented to the jury, essentially what we objected to, see if I can clarify this, was that the court refused our request to have a jury instruction that indicated that to the extent that a right under a contract is assigned to a third party, in this case, Chemetall, is claiming that the confidentiality provisions of the agreement at issue were assigned to them, that they're assigned completely and exclusively, and that's the law of Illinois, and that was the law that we sought a jury instruction on.
But I don't think that, if the court thought that wasn't the law, in fact, I'm looking at your brief on page 35, and you definitely, both in boldface and in your discussion, are talking about improper consideration of parole evidence. And I don't know why you think the law of Illinois doesn't allow partial assignments, and I don't know why either. What was assigned was this business, this zirconium business, and we then had the employment agreement that was signed that said, I will keep confidential information I've learned both during and after my employment. So if he was still an employee of Morton, he had to keep it confidential. If he wasn't an employee of Morton vis-a-vis this part of the business, he had to keep it confidential too.
Correct.
So I don't see why, you know, he didn't agree to a long-term confidentiality agreement, and then he also agreed ex ante to let Morton assign this, you know, these conditions. Not even that. The above conditions shall apply to all work and shall be binding upon the assigned executors and shall inure to the benefit of the successors and assigns of the company. So he agrees at the start of things to let this agreement inure to the benefit of later people.
Yes, Your Honor.
Surely, Chemetall is a later company in this line.
Surely Chemetall could be a later company in this line, and that is the crux of the issue. If this agreement entered into between Morton and Chemetall, Morton is the one that had the confidentiality agreement with Preval, assigned the confidentiality obligations to Chemetall.
But see, that's what I don't see. What it assigned was the zirconium metal powder business. There was the sale of assets, and that part of the business went to, I don't know, it's a German company, where they pronounce it Chemetall or Chemtall or whatever. But with the assignment of that part of the business, then the confidentiality obligation flows insofar as it's happened to that part of the business.
Well, that's the issue, whether or not that agreement was assigned. And it was established, I think, and
I understand, maybe I'll just say that, you know, I understand that you think that that's the way we should consider this issue. I don't think it has anything to do with assignment of the confidentiality agreement. The confidentiality agreement just says it applies and it inures to the benefit of successors and assigns of the company. It doesn't say it's going to be assigned somehow to successors and assigns of the company.
Well, certainly, and I agree with all of that, Your Honor, but it only inures to a successor or assign of the company if they're a successor or assign of the company. So you have to establish that in this case, Chemetall is claiming they're an assignee of the company. So they have to establish the assignment. And here we have a situation where Mr. Preval continued working for Morton after the sale of
But not in the zirconium powder business.
No, not in the zirconium powder business.
So your worldview does not include the idea of partial sales of assets or businesses.
No, it includes that. I have no problem with the partial sale of business or assets. And I don't have...
Just that you forfeit all right to have, you know, the employees of the old company that can then go and publish on the front page of the Wall Street Journal all the trade secrets for the...
No. I don't agree with that either. You have a situation where, to protect it, you can have an assignment of those types of confidentiality agreements. In this particular case, the asset purchase agreement obligated Morton to obtain undertakings from their existing employees, providing just for that.
But why couldn't Morton have taken the position that it already had that, at least from Mr. Frival, in this other agreement?
Well, that's essentially what Chemetall has done. They've said, well, Morton didn't do that. They didn't go out and comply with this provision of the contract that said they had to get a specific undertaking from their employees to keep confidential all the information about the metals powders business, which, by the way, is much broader than the confidentiality undertaking in the patent and trade secret agreement. The patent and trade secret agreement only precludes Mr. Frival from disclosing proprietary information that's not in the public domain. The undertaking in the contract between Morton and Chemetall was much broader than that. Said all this know-how that Morton has and is selling to us, you've got to keep confidential, regardless of whether it's proprietary. You can't go out and use it. It's ours. You've got to non-compete for 5 years. That's not what the Frival trade secret agreement says. That only limits them from disclosing proprietary information. The fact of the matter is that Mr. Frival continued to work for Morton after the sale of that business and continued under the same employment agreement. The plaintiffs have stipulated that this is an employment agreement and that transfer of employment agreements or assumption of obligations of employment agreements were expressly excluded from the asset purchase agreement. He continued to work for Morton pursuant to the same employment agreement, the trade secret agreement, owing the confidentiality undertakings to Morton on an ongoing basis up through 1997. That was the agreement in effect between he and Morton between 1989 through 1997 when he left Morton. So clearly the contract as a whole was not assigned to Chemetall. And Chemetall was not the successor in interest to the contract as a whole. So Chemetall, and this is where we get into the jury instruction issue, Chemetall is placed in the position where it has to argue partial assignment. And it's true that Illinois law allows partial assignments. You can have a stream of payments that you partially assign out to a third party, but you cannot assign something and then retain that same thing. In other words,
if it is the same thing, but the theory that you are avoiding is that confidentiality might apply to different aspects of the business. Morton has no interest whatsoever in the zirconium business anymore. They couldn't care less, I assume, if Mr. Frival goes and talks to anybody in the world about it. But that part follows to the extent the assets moved.
And
the new obligation is owed to Chemetall, not Morton.
I understand that, and that is the position that was essentially taken by the trial court. And our position is...
And what was wrong with it, and how did you alert the district court in some way? What did you want them to say, and where is it in the record for the jury instruction, so the jury would have had to somehow focus on your theory?
We wanted an instruction, and it's in the conference, the transcript of the conference with the court. We wanted an instruction that provided that if a right is assigned, it's completely assigned.
But that would have been wrong. You've just stood here and told us that that's not the
case. No. That wouldn't be wrong. That is the correct state of the law in Illinois. You cannot, for example, assign to, Morton couldn't assign to Chemetall the right to receive $100 and then say, but we still retain that right. You pay them the $100, but you pay us the $100 too, which is
fundamentally changing the obligation of the employee, so now we have to pay $200. Now we have a situation where they're trying to parse out this confidentiality undertaking, which is not subdivided within this agreement. It is a confidentiality undertaking to its employer, period. And they say, well, it should be construed to allow us to assign a portion of that confidentiality undertaking that's not broken out in the agreement at our own discretion to a third party without Mr. Frivol's permission, consent, or knowledge. And that is what we're saying is not permissible. You cannot expand the obligations, the confidentiality obligations, beyond yourself to a third party without the employee's consent. And what they're effectively doing through that is changing the assignment function to a third-party beneficiary function, which they've acknowledged in their response brief. This is not a third-party beneficiary case. They don't meet the standards for a third-party beneficiary. And you can't circumvent those standards by saying, okay, well, we, rather than being a third-party beneficiary, can receive a partial assignment of a non-divisible obligation by the employee.
Before you sit down, I just want to ask a question about that Exhibit 150. Was there evidence that the process described in the exhibit is the same as the one used by Morton?
Yes, Judge Williams, and this is very, very important because the way the facts played out in the underlying proceeding, Chemetall was limited in their presentation of evidence in establishing any trade secrets by the existence of this Eagle Picture Report, which was published by Dr. Donald Smith, our expert in the case, back in the 1970s, which set out the procedure and the mechanism to make zirconium metal powder, ZMP. So what Chemetall had to do was say, okay, everything that's in that report we can't say is a secret, so we're down to 15 things that we did that ZR Energy does that is not listed in that report. So we're down to these 15 things. And if you get that exhibit, and it's a substantial effect to the final outcome of the case, because if you introduce that exhibit, that wipes away virtually all of those 15 remaining items. And it wipes away all of the four items that the judge ultimately found from those 15 items were something that could constitute a trade secret that could be infringed in this case. So if that is in the case, Chemetall is faced with the Eagle Picture Report and with Exhibit 150, the Hughes Report, which is in Dr. Smith's files, noted to him. It doesn't have any type of limitation on it as to the use. Any indication that it's proprietary was indicated in the transcript with our motion to reconsider, that he produced it without going through his company because there was nothing on the face of it that said it was confidential or proprietary or otherwise had to be limited for disclosure. And it's a third party's analysis that has a detailed description of the process and flowcharts and diagrams that identifies almost all. There are a couple of things that aren't in there, but almost all, and all of the ones that the judge found to be rising to the level of trade secrets.
But of course, he wasn't on the list of recipients.
He was written on
right. This
document, which under the analysis, what you've got to do is see if it's in a location where you would expect it to be.
So why would you expect it to be in his file?
Because this is the one that has the handwritten designation to him. Where else would it be? The one with the handwritten designation to him, showing that somebody at Hughes sent it over to him, this central guy at Eagle Picture, who's spearheading this whole process to make the production process for zirconium metal powder publicly available, gets this information. So it's provided to him. It's not confidential. It's not proprietary. It's in his files. It's where he would expect it to be if it's manually CC'd to him. And the importance of the document is precisely the fact that it is in his file. It's a Hughes Aircraft memorandum that's in his file. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Griffin. Mr. Shore.
Thank you, Your Honor. Judge Williams, I'm going to pick up with your question. Was there evidence that, was there anything in the record which would suggest that Exhibit 150, proffered but rejected, showed the Morton process? And the answer to that question is no. At most, it showed aspects of a process in 1994, and of course, what was at issue at trial and what was submitted to the jury was what was the process in manufacturing instructions existing in 1994, 20 years later. And so, at best, the disputed exhibit was ambivalent. It showed something, arguably, that may have happened 20 years earlier.
You mean it showed the process? I think you may have misspoke. It showed the process in 1974, right?
Yes,
and
yes,
then,
ma'am.
Okay, yeah.
I'm sorry if I'm
maybe
stated.
I misheard you too, so I just want to be sure.
And in that context, let me address briefly the subject of waiver on relative to Exhibit 150. This is a particular good example of why objections should be made at the trial level at an appropriate time. The ruling on Exhibit 150 was made as part of a motion in limite at the beginning of trial and then addressed during trial. It was only at the end of the trial, however, where the exhibit really took on life. The proponent of the exhibit was supposed to be this Dr. Smith, their expert. He, in fact, was the last witness in the trial. Both sides rested immediately after his testimony. And as a ruling on evidence, a preliminary ruling, like every other ruling, it was subject to reconsideration. Had the defendants taken the opportunity at that point in time to submit an offer of proof based on what they claimed Exhibit 150 might have shown and moved for judgment as a matter of law or to reopen the evidence, Dr. Smith was right there to testify about it, had they done so.
Did they use that document to refresh his recollection?
No, and that's my next point, Your Honor. The question of prejudice here. We don't believe there was any error whatsoever because the factual finding that this document wasn't where it might have been expected to be found was clearly supported by the record, and so there was no error. But Judge Shaker was very careful. He said, now I'm excluding the evidence, but I want you to understand explicitly, I'm not going to preclude you from examining Dr. Smith, a percipient witness, about the same facts, about his visit to this facility, what he saw, the circumstances of it, what he remembered about it. And further, if he doesn't remember, you can use the same document to refresh his memory. And he did testify about the plant visit, and the defendants did not avail themselves of their opportunity either to use the document to attempt to refresh his memory or as a basis for a motion for JMOL based on an offer of proof. So this is a problem that could have been fixed before the case was submitted to the jury, before the instructions, and they just didn't do it. And it's a perfectly appropriate case for a waiver to be imposed on that basis. They had a full opportunity to examine a witness, to refresh his memory, to move for reconsideration, and to make their record, and they didn't. There was no error, but at best it was harmless because of the actual live testimony, and finally they waived it. I only want to address the contract issues briefly, Your Honors, and respond to just a few comments made in Mr. Griffin's argument. We have here two written agreements. Judge Kaur addressed them initially, and although he denied what we had characterized as a motion, a cross motion, his ruling denying their motion for judgment under Rule 12 was quite clear in that he interpreted the agreements exactly as we did. That is, if you put the two agreements together, the Frival Employment Agreement and the Chemetall Asset Purchase Agreement, there was only one conclusion you could reach. Mr. Frival bound himself to confidentiality. Mr. Frival affirmed that this obligation would inure to the benefit of successors and assigns. And the Chemetall Morton Agreement established quite clearly that it, in fact, Chemetall was a successor or assign. Judge Kaur agreed with us that that particular issue could be decided as a matter of law, and his ruling so held. Judge Shanker said, I'm not so sure, and I'm going to let you put both sides put in evidence on the subject. And they did. And the issue was subject to evidence. Mr. Edmonston testified consistent with Chemetel's theory. He, as the representative of Morton, reviewed the Fraval agreement, said it was a standard kind of agreement for Morton. Its intent was to bind employees before and after their employment to confidentiality. And he, as one of the negotiators on behalf of Morton, said that the Morton-Chemetel purchase agreement and the provision that I have mentioned, binding the Morton employees to confidentiality, was something that would inure to the benefit of Chemetel.
Can I ask, if I understand Mr. Griffin's argument correctly, it is that although he will concede that Illinois recognizes partial assignments, he sees a limitation that only sort of pre-severed things can be partially assigned, things that are visibly separate in the business of a company or in agreements. And his problem is that this confidentiality obligation was a global obligation, and now it's being carved up into different areas. I think that's what he's saying. And I don't know of any case in Illinois that addresses this particular kind of partial assignment, but perhaps you can help me.
I don't view this as a partial assignment issue. This is not a $100 bill that you can't tear in half, okay? Mm-hmm. And give half to each, and then each can get $100 from it. What is involved here is a unified duty of confidentiality. That is what Mr. Fraval obligated himself to. The question is, who has the right to enforce that? Under defendant's theory, only one person has that right, and that's Morton. Now, they concede in their reply brief that even after Chemetel acquired that aspect of the business, Fraval still owed the duty to Morton.
Right.
Now, if that were the law, consider the anomalous situation that a company like Morton, a company like Chemetel, and this court would find itself in. The legal duty exists, but the only way to enforce it would be for the predecessor company to bring a lawsuit based on a part of the business that it has no longer any interest in. And that doesn't make sense as a matter of policy. And to establish such a rule in this case, I believe would really place a lot of businesses in a quandary. How could they partially divest assets of their business? How could they ever sell a particular line of business that has trade secrets or other intellectual property without doing one of two things? Either running the risk that they have no right to enforce confidentiality relating to those agreements, or on the other hand, to employ every single employee involved in that for the transferring business.
But Mr. Griffin seems to concede that if, I'm not sure whether it was Chemetel or Morton, but if somebody had taken advantage of paragraph 18B and executed a new secrecy undertaking, then we wouldn't be here. Then it would be clear that there was a secrecy obligation vis-a-vis these trade secrets that applied to Mr. Fraval.
It certainly, had Mr. Fraval signed a new agreement, we might be here with claims under a different agreement. But I certainly don't think that hypothetical obviates the contract that was in fact in existence. In fact, he signed five or six of them with various companies in the chain, ending with Morton International, each one of which said, this duty of confidentiality is a duty you owe, and it's a duty you owe to us as well as to our successors and assigns. And that's what the agreement was.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't think that to characterize this as a partial assignment case is right. The duty of confidentiality and the obligations that were imposed upon Mr. Fraval by that never changed. It was a unified duty to protect information. His obligations were not increased as a result of Chemetel's asset acquisition. They were exactly the same as they had been before. He was still obligated to keep certain things confidential. The ruling that is sought would, again, from a policy perspective, if what Chemetel and Morton tried to accomplish through this provision didn't legally happen, then every time there is a partial transaction like this, all of the employees of the former company who aren't employed could go out and publish in the Wall Street Journal or set up competing business. And that just can't be right as a matter of policy. The last point I'd like to make is very brief. We've been talking completely about the contract cause of action in this case. And of course, there was a separate cause of action tried for trade secrets. And the verdict form set that out separately. The instructions set that out separately. So for if any reason the court were persuaded, and we don't think there is any such reason, but if you were persuaded that there's a problem with the contract verdict, there's no reason to send this back for another trial because the verdict on the trade secret claims stands independent. And for those reasons, we request affirmance.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Schwarz. Mr. Griffin. I think you have 1 minute left.
Thank you, Judge. Briefly on the document 150, it is not sufficient to just allow it to be used to refresh someone's recollection, especially when you're talking about something that occurred more than 25 years ago. The Cady's case of this circuit is a very, very good example. It wouldn't have been effective to try and refresh someone's recollection with those identity documents. They needed those identity documents, which came from the Soviets' archives, not from the SS archives. The SS certainly never contemplated that it would end up in the Soviet archives, but through the vagaries of the war and the factual circumstances, it did, and it ended up in a place where you expected to find it, just as this document ended up in a place you would expect to find it with the manual CC to Dr. Smith. The importance of this document is the material that's in it. I frankly don't care what Morton's process was in 1994 with respect to this document. I care about this document because the aspects of the process that it shows are the aspects of the process that Chemetel claims are secret. Thank you.
Thank you. Our thanks to all counsel. The case is taken under advisement.